The Senate Judiciary Budget Division will come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 13th in the year 2007. And welcome. I appreciate the good attendance that we have, but obviously we must have something that somebody wants.
In the right place. Huh?
We don't have a quorum, do we? We're lacking quorum anyhow, but we're going to proceed without that. There's no need for an overview on the budget to require that. So we will start with Sue Dussel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the division. My name is, for the record, Sue Dussel. I'm the state court administrator, and I'm here with a number of other folks who are going to help me present the judicial branch budget for this next biennium. Just by way of starting, you know the judiciary, of course, is a core government function provided for in the Constitution. Oh, sorry. Thank you very much. Certainly wouldn't want that to happen. Brilliant slides here. And we have slides in your packet, too, if you'd like to follow along that way. Provided for in the Constitution as, of course, one of the three co-equal branches of government, charged with protecting the individual rights of our citizens as set out in Article 1 in our Minnesota Bill of Rights. And this includes the constitutional guarantee that all disputes, both civil and criminal, be handled promptly and without delay. And that, of course, is the basis, the mission on which our budget proposal is based. A few facts. We have 3,000 employees, a little over 300 judges operating in 100 locations around the state, handle 2 million cases each year. Our base budget is about $281 million, and each year we collect about $191 million, which is distributed to the state general fund, to a number of state dedicated funds, and also to county and city government. And The green sheet in your packet on the right-hand side kind of gives you the picture of where that $191 million is distributed. As many of you know, the judiciary completed recently its 15-year journey of transferring the funding responsibility for our trial courts from the counties to the state. And so this is the first biennium in which the judicial branch is fully state-funded. So this is the first biennium that our budget fate rests entirely with you. The judicial branch appropriation is divided into three separate budgets, one for each level of court. Our change level requests for the next biennium are in these five categories that are listed here. And so I'd like to start first with the strategic initiatives. The Judicial Council, which is our new governing body for the judicial branch following state funding, has adopted a strategic plan for the branch going forward the next several years that focuses on access to justice, effectiveness, and accountability. And you can see these are their three overarching goals, and we have a number of initiatives under them to achieve those goals. Seven of those initiatives we are internally funding, and three we're asking for funding from the legislature for. And these are the three that are listed on this slide. The first is a request to fund a phase one of a multi-year drug court initiative. And this request comes out of the report of a multidisciplinary group, their Supreme Court Chemical Dependency Task Force, that worked for 18 months, studied this issue intensively, and at the end of it called for a broad and fundamental shift in how we are dealing with AOD, that's alcohol and other drugs, is sort of our acronym, AOD, offenders, because what we're doing today does not work. AOD is a pervasive problem in Minnesota. We have something over 33,000 DWI arrests each year. Many are repeat offenders. One in nine licensed drivers has a DWI on their record. AOD is a factor in 80% of the criminal cases. It impacts juvenile delinquency, child protection, family cases, and others as well. From 2000 to 2005, drug cases increased by nearly 70%, and we know that meth accounted for a significant part of that increase. But in just this last year, we've seen a very significant surge in the DWI area as well.
Ms. Dosell, on this slides that you're working there, you're dealing with AOD. Are you, do you have included anywhere the mental health problem people?
We don't identify it here, but certainly mental health is a significant portion of folks that come into drug court. There is many of them have co-occurring issues, and so that would be in addition to this. We also have mental health issues that are separate from them, and perhaps you know that in both Hennepin and Ramsey County, we have mental health courts that are dealing with that, where the mental health is the primary presenting symptom. In drug court, we keep those in drug court where the primary issue is alcohol, but there is some mental health issues. And I think you saw when we were in Ramsey County that they had a forensic nurse that deals in the psychiatric areas, and the same thing is true in some of these other drug courts as well. So they're recognizing that they're, both of these things are going on and trying to deal with them.
In spite of the fact that you've got dual diagnosis, then you're approaches to handle those singularly?
I'm sorry.
The drug, you're treating the drug people in one court and the mentally ill on the other side in another court?
Well, it depends on the presenting symptoms, that as I indicated, and I believe as we were told when you all were in Ramsey County that a lot of times you have to get the drug issue out of the way before you know what are mental health issues. So we have, at least in Hennepin-Ramsey, we have both of these issues that are being handled both in the drug court and in the mental health court.
Okay. Senator Engelbert.
Mr. Chair, just two questions. 33 DWI arrests. What was that 10 years ago?
33,000.
33,000, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I'd have to.
Also, the meths in 2005 obviously increased a lot. You're looking better for 2006.
We'd have to look at that. Yeah. I'm not sure. It may be plateauing. I've heard that meth is beginning to plateau some. I've got some nods in the back that we're beginning to see some plateau in there.
Okay.
But we continue to see this growth here generally.
Sure. Thank you.
What we know nationally about relapse and recidivism is that rates are very high for people that are offenders, AOD offenders that are just simply sent to prison.
Sure.
1998 national study showed that 30% of those released were rearrested within 6 months, nearly 70% within 3 years, and nearly all returned to AOD use soon after release. And then 2006 legislative auditor report on substance abuse treatment shows that our recidivism rates really track quite closely with these national rates. Now, we have in recent years discovered a more effective approaches to dealing with AOD offenders, and these are drug courts and what we call problem-solving strategies. Drug courts use the coercive power of the court in collaboration with justice system stakeholders to closely monitor AOD offenders and their road to recovery and sobriety through the regular drug testing, ongoing treatment, frequent court check-ins, and the use of immediate sanctions and incentives. Drug courts are designed to provide greater offender oversight and public safety. They emphasize treatment and rehabilitation, but with sanctions, both sanctions and incentives, and are attempting to restore offenders to law-abiding lives. Now, drug courts improve outcomes for AOD offenders by enhancing their chances for long-term sobriety and recovery and their overall social functioning as well. By reducing recidivism and therefore avoiding future criminal justice costs and future costs to victims and other victims as well. Now, this slide is why nationally drug courts have grown from the first one in 1989 in Miami, that's Dade County, Florida, to over 1,900 nationwide today. Minnesota is definitely behind the curve in terms of drug courts. We have only two drug courts that have been operating for 5 years or more, and most of our drug courts just got started in the last 2 years, as you can see on this slide. Currently, we have 19 operating drug courts throughout the state. They're in those counties where they're in the pink in the slide here. Many of those got one-time startup money from federal grants, and we also have had a number of drug courts that got started in by using state legislative appropriations just approved this last biennium. So I want to give you a kind of a boots-on-the-ground information by calling on a number of people that have been working in drug courts. We first have a panel that come from Chisago County and are members of the drug court team there. And I wonder if I could call Judge Rancourt, who is the judge in that county and started the juvenile drug court, and Bonnie Vader, who is their education liaison, and Commissioner Schultz, county commissioner, also is a member of the drug team.
Welcome to the hearing. Would you please start with you, Judge, and say your name, where you're from, for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Judge Robert Rancourt. I'm a district court judge in Chisago County, which is about 45 miles northeast of St. Paul. I've been a judge for 5 years. I have run a juvenile drug court now since December of 2004. Martin Luther King Jr. is quoted as saying, "Life's most urgent question is what are you doing for others?" And the implementation of drug courts, I have found, is a way of doing something different from others that we have done in the past. As Mr. Sell has indicated, there are currently over 1,900 drug courts operations in the United States. Minnesota currently has about 19. It is clear to me that drug courts and drug court principals are becoming institutionalized as a way of doing business in the courts. The reasons are clear. Recent statistics by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, known as SAMHSA, show that the state of Minnesota ranks third in the country for those individuals between the ages of 18 to 20 who state they use methamphetamine in the past year. That was a question you had raised, Senator, to Mr. Sell as well. And as it relates to the methamphetamine statistics, I did have some additional statistics from Hazleton Foundation, which stated that methamphetamine abuse and addiction remained apparent through the Twin Cities and the state in 2005. This report was a June of 2006 report, with some signs of leveling. 12% of admissions to Twin Cities area addiction treatment programs were for methamphetamine in 2005. Compared with 3.1% in 2000. Yet methamphetamine-related accidental deaths fell to 14 in 2005 from 20 in 2004 and 24 in 2003. State Drug Task Force data showed a 78% decrease in meth lab seized. That's what you were relating to, and that's based upon some of the good legislation that has come out of the Senate and the House, and a 75% reduction in arrests for meth manufacturers. However, what you have to understand is what we're starting to see in the courts is not so much the manufacturing of meth. We're starting to see property crimes. And that's where methamphetamine addicts are stealing copper, committing property crimes so they can get money to buy meth. So they're looking at a different approach. And the other thing that's somewhat concerning based upon the Hazleton statistics is opiate-related accidental overdose deaths increased and outnumbered those for any other illicit drug with 102 in 2005 compared with 72 in 2004 and 69 in 2003. And most of the opiate-related deaths involved heroin, while some involved oxycodone, fentanyl, or methadone. So you sometimes see a shift in the trend, of course, of drug use and abuse, with alcohol still being the biggest problem that we have, of course. Of the 8,300 offenders currently in prison in Minnesota, 90% were diagnosed as chemically dependent or chemically abusive. 60% of offenders need primary treatment, and 65% of those did not get treatment. And as the chair had asked about co-occurring and mental disorders, one of the issues in prison, of course, is if you commit a disciplinary offense, you may not be eligible for treatment. And if you have mental health issues, of course, which a lot of people do in prison, they're not eligible for treatment as a result of that because of disciplinary offenses.
Well, and tell me, Judge, why do you do that? I mean, why?
I don't do that, Mr. Chair. I just send them there. But I think they're taking a hard look at that as well. I think the part of the crisis we see, of course, relating to mental health, and I think Ms. Dosell had indicated this very, very well, it's difficult to determine if the mental health is a drug-induced mental health issue or if it's independent of the drug, meaning that the drug is being used to medicate a person who has a mental health issue. So many times, of course, they have to get into situations where they can have some detoxification period where they can level off the drug and they can start determining whether or not that individual has mental health issues. I'm not sure if the prisons are really equipped to handle mental health issues. That's just my opinion. It's a difficult issue to handle, and when you have that many drug offenders that may be entering the prison system, that is a concern. The U.S. Government Accountability Office in February of 2005 provided an extensive review of drug court research, which showed that most adult drug court programs evidence lower rearrest and conviction rates for drug court participants than comparison groups. The GAO used a cost-benefit analysis, which I'm sure would be interesting to the Senate, and determined the cost associated with implementing or operating a program and weighing that cost against any benefits experienced from the program. And the results of the cost-benefit analysis was reported as either a net benefit or can be reported as either a net benefit or calculated as total benefits minus total cost or a benefit-to-cost ratio, calculated as total benefits to the participant divided by total costs. And the GAO, in fact, used a net benefit analysis. That result showed a net benefit of approximately up to $15,000 per participant in the drug courts which they had analyzed. This analysis primarily relates to reduction in recidivism. That's a rearrest and conviction. And that's underestimated, Mr. Chair and members, because what that cost-benefit analysis does not do is evaluate the reduced medical cost of treating and not curing, of course, but assisting addicts, increased worker productivity of those individuals that might be part of the workforce. Reductions in recidivism can lead to benefits or cost savings for criminal justice agencies and for potential victims of crime. A reduction in the number of arrests would result in a reduction in expenditures for the agencies, including police, prosecution, courts, corrections department, and probation agencies. Potential victims' benefits from reduced recidivism mean costs such as lost property values, medical expenses due to assaults, possibly, quality of life costs relating to pain and suffering, benefits to society as a result of a reduction in substance abuse, avoiding medical costs such as medical services a treated addict would require. Labor market outcomes may improve, meaning they aren't employable and can pay taxes, which is a benefit to society in general. Reduce homelessness, reduce child welfare costs, delayed parenting for juveniles, and improve school attendance and high school graduation rates. The issue of a drug court many people look at is just adult drug courts, but this model basically looks at the complete spectrum of what we see in the courts on a daily basis, both from the family courts of child protection cases, domestic assault cases, DUI cases, even dissolution cases to some extent. I mean, that's how much alcohol and drug is involved in our court system. And we've looked at different ways as judges, and there's tremendous leaders in the state that have taken this on, including Judge Lynch, who is sitting back here, way before my time, and I commend them for that effort, because what we're trying to do is stop the continuing recycling of families in the courts and sending them to prison. I think the average cost for prison is $30,000 per year for someone we would send to prison. And with the presumptive sentencing guidelines, a lot of people do go. And a lot of people, and I see obviously County Attorney Baxter will be talking to you shortly, some people belong there. There's no question about that either for public safety issues. I would like to share a letter from one of our drug court graduates with you, if I could. This was a young lady who was a methamphetamine addict. I used to see her in the juvenile court from time to time. She came out of one of our holding cells one day, was totally disheveled, and I looked at this young lady, beautiful young girl, I think she was about 16 years of age, full of potential, but no hope. And I looked at her and indicated to her that we would not give up on her as a court. And she looked back at me and says, I'm not going to give up on you either. And I really didn't know what that meant. And I thought about that for the next 2 weeks. But in any event, this is her letter after she graduated from the program. She said, I have been a drug court for about 2 years now. I have learned a lot about myself in that time. I have now been sober for 6 months, and I feel very confident that I will continue to stay sober after I leave drug court. I have a very good school support system for my family, Barb, and my really sweet friends. I am also planning on keeping my sponsor, and my teachers at school are really supportive and always willing to help me out. This school year started off a little rocky because I did not have all the resources that I needed, but that is all taken care of now, and I'm caught up in school. So far, my basic plans for the future are to move in with my sister at the end of the month and find a good job. I am also very excited to finish school because I found out that I am right on track, and I plan to do all of this without any chemicals. My life prior to drug court was like a roller coaster. There were frequent mood swings and tones of drama. I don't think I was ever really happy. Now today, after drug court, I have had a job, am in school, and doing good. I talk to my family and have hobbies and really great friends. But most of all, I can walk down the street with my head held high and truly smile with real happiness and know that I'm going to be okay. The thing that I would have to say I'm most grateful for from drug court is that they helped me to get a relationship back with my dad, which is really something that was really eating at me. So I thank you guys for that because it has helped me in more ways than you guys could ever know. Now that I am sober, my relationships are much better because these are real and not false ones. And that's what you see with drug court judges throughout the state and the country. You'll see a lot of those type of graduates talk about that. And these are long-term programs and intensive programs. I think there's a misnomer from time to time that drug courts are a coddling court, meaning that you're really coddling criminals, and that's not it at all. They're much more intensive in design. They're much more sanction-oriented. There's rewards, obviously, as well. But there's immediate consequence, and that's different than what we've had before in the judicial system, in my opinion. I'm going to close by indicating a quote from George Bernard Shaw that said, life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of a splendid torch which I have got a hold of for that moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. And one thing is elected officials, you are blessed, quite frankly, to be representing your constituents and have the ability to affect change. And I'm a recent granddad as of last Tuesday. And when I think of a grandchild coming into my life now, I look at her future. And I look at the potential of passing a torch to her where we have a better judicial system from the way we do handle addicts that are coming before our courts. And hopefully we can rehabilitate them and lower the cost to the government as a whole. So I thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Let the record show we do have a quorum. I have Lynn Schultz.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
I'm the hot seat. Okay. Lynn Schultz, Chisago County Commissioner. Drug court works. That's the phrase I heard when I attended my first drug court training conference. Why does Chisago County's Juvenile Substance Abuse Court work? It's because of the coordinated effort of the judiciary, the prosecution, defense, probation, law enforcement, social services, educators, and the other stakeholders. Most importantly, it works because of the commitment of my colleagues, Judge Rancourt and Vonnie Vader, and the rest of the drug court team. It is our goal to provide direction and structure in the lives of those young people that come before us. Many lack the tools of self-esteem, support, to make better choices in their life. We give them the mechanism to make these positive changes. When people enter the judicial system, be it the state, county, federal, a drain opens on the taxation system and money begins to trickle away. When that system becomes a revolving door for individuals, the plug gets pulled and the money drains away in full force. Documented results show that no other jurisdiction intervention can bring as dramatic response as drug court. Even an outcome of harm reduction improves the quality of life for the individual, the family, and for our communities. How can we go wrong if we put taxpayer dollars into creating productive individuals that are invested in our communities? Individuals and families that enter the judicial system with disdain, anger, and lack of hope learn that the system is not just one of punishment, but one that desires a better life for those that enter its process. Our participants learn many facets about their community. In addition to law enforcement and judicial, they are exposed to community service, county staff, and educators as advocates rather than adversaries. They see a judicial system that supports, reinforces, and gives hope for a more promising future. As a county commissioner, I struggle to meet the needs of my county. And unfortunately, the first line of funding to get sacrificed is usually in the area of prevention. Many counties, like Chisago, are wringing their hands, contemplating building new jails and asking, what can we do with all these prisoners? The answer is to prevent some of them from being prisoners. Our juvenile drug court has shown me a way to do an intervention before they've been a drain on the system for many years. The fact is, we will pay one way or another at this point in time or in the future. It's a matter of prioritizing when and how we will pay. Economic development is a critical element of property tax relief for the residents of Chisago County, and I assume in other places as well. Our HRA and EDAs are focusing on a skilled workforce as a means of attracting business to our county. But I'm told one of the main problems for employers is finding people that can pass a drug test. And that is just the front end of the relationship between employers and employees. The workforce of our state needs attention. We must do more to prevent relapse, to aid recovery, and to reduce the recidivism, that revolving door offender. To start, we need to recognize and acknowledge that drug court addresses this recidivism as a major stumbling block to recovery, and it's far more effective than the traditional legal process. A paradigm shift is needed in the thinking. It's necessary to create productive citizens rather than prisoners. County budgets and taxpayers are screaming for change. The mantra of our JSAC team is, if we keep doing what we keep doing, we'll keep getting what we've been getting. We are trying to do something different. To be sustainable, we need your help. Give drug courts the funding and opportunity to change lives, reduce drug use, and create safer communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Bonnie Bader. Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
I will. Good afternoon. My name is Bonnie Bader, and I work for the Chisago Lakes Public Schools, and I am the director of their Level 4 Day Treatment Program and the Recovery School. As I was pondering and preparing for this opportunity, I struggled to land on what I could possibly say in 3 to 5 minutes that would have an impact convincing you as powerful decision makers that this process, the drug court process, works, and it not only works, but it is the good and right thing to do for kids. And it perhaps is more economically efficient than perhaps constructing more prisons. I wondered, as I was thinking about this, of just saying and telling you I have spent 30 years, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, working with young people labeled at risk or emotionally disturbed and behaviorally disordered would be enough, and to tell you that I've learned the common theme that has rung true over all 30 years of that is their need to connect with healthy people. And 30 years in working with, in the trenches, if you will, with at-risk kids makes me a different sort of educator, since our life expectancy in this work is 3 years. I wondered if telling you that I've been taught by the best young people with at-risk behaviors across 3 states in several counties, and that the One thing I've learned from them is the greatest gift we can give to them is gifts, is consistency, structure, empathy, and accountability. That's what I've learned from them. As my career comes to a close, and it has been filled with scientific research-based strategies. It's been filled with sad stories, sometimes frightening encounters, but rich beyond belief with successes and filled with people who have done what is right and good for kids. It's become extremely clear, and I underscore it is clear. Punishment is not what changes behavior and empowers people to make good choices. Several years ago, adolescent young men presented, these young men had extensive criminal history, presented to a group of county professionals in Chisago County, and the following are profound statements and some profound recommendations that they made. First of all, a statement from one young man was, when I stopped connecting with healthy people, I started connecting with stuff, in other words, drugs. And I can't tell you how that encapsulates my 30 years experience across the board of all the kids that I've dealt with. Another young man said, when I was using, I knew just how many times I could get busted before I was in serious criminal trouble. And another statement was, there isn't anybody to keep me out of trouble, so why not use? The recommendations that they gave were, when we offend, in other words, when we're caught, we need to get into court much quicker so we know this is serious. Delay only contributes to our denial and our minimizing of our own behavior. We need to have more personal contact with community and school people so we know that we belong. Think about that. So they know they belong. From these recommendations and the increase in drug use in our community, the realization, and as this comes from our drug court, as Lynn said, if we keep doing what we've been doing, we're going to keep getting what we've been getting. And that was a clear statement from our kids. Under Judge Rancourt's leadership, Chisago County Juvenile Substance Abuse Court, in other words, JSAC is the acronym, the team was implemented. Multiple agencies working together. What a novel idea. Communicating on a regular basis and on a frequent basis provides young people with strong and unified support as well as clear and concise expectations. Research plays those two things out as the best ways to change behavior. These characteristics of the drug court process are important, extremely important to modify and change behavior. From the educational view, this process is incredibly positive. Young people involved with JSAC believe that the members of JSAC, all of the multiple agencies, know all of their negative behaviors. And from an educator's standpoint, that's a blessing. So attendance in school increases, work performance improves, personal integrity is heightened because they assume there are no weak links in the communication chain. The weak link in communication in the eyes of a young person, they take that and skillfully use that to their advantage, and it isn't to ours. Throughout my career, professionals have identified the need for agencies involved with adolescents to work together and support each other in a difficult task of providing accountability and clear expectations to the youth that we all work with. This is a long-wished-for opportunity, and it not only works for young people, but it's a great support for professionals. The people working together to accomplish more and with greater efficiency. Research has confirmed repeatedly two characteristics necessary and key in the lives of all young people for effective change. One is positive adult relationships, and kids told us that very simply and clearly without a lot of research knowledge on their own, and immediate sanctions and rewards. Immediate is key. A recent graduate of Chisago County, a different one than what Judge Rancourt read the letter from, said, if I hadn't been in drug court every week, or if drug court had only been 6 months long, I know I wouldn't have graduated from high school on the B Honor Roll, nor would I be employed right now, in other words, paying taxes. I'm doing well and it took too long to get here, so I'm not going to mess it up now. Perhaps a benefit from the drug court process that wasn't quite as apparent to us all initially, but is becoming a very real and important component, is the parental support. And in my mind's eye, this is huge. And in fact, it came home last week where a parent said to me, "My wife and I were so fatigued, and we had nothing left to give and nothing left to try. We are all so thankful for drug court because we are no longer fighting this battle alone, and we have been revitalized." Thank you. Personally, as an educator, I feel so fortunate to be a part of something that works so effectively for young people and so many agencies working together to do what is right and good. Thank you.
Just quick with a question, the judge. What's the difference between handling an offender, if you will, in adult court and versus the juvenile court in regard to the court, drug court, for example?
That's a fair question. I don't have an adult drug court in Chisago County at this time, Mr. Chair. However, in a lot of ways, I think it would be easier to handle an adult offender than it is a juvenile offender. And I think the research shows that as well, because you're dealing with the adolescent brain beyond the fact that you're dealing with an addict, with a juvenile. In addition, we don't have the sanctions or consequences that you have in adult court. For example, if we would have an adult offender that we would place into an adult drug court, one of the remedies, of course, is a stay of execution of sentence as far as that individual's sentence, meaning that we would sentence that individual to prison, however, stay execution of that sentence on the condition that he follows the drug court requirements. And if that offender does not do so, then that offender can go to prison as far as a sanction. So you have a more of a hammer, if you will, in the adult court setting. The benefits are still the same. As a judge, if I'm going to depart from the guidelines, and one of the ways you can depart from the sentencing guidelines, of course, is to find that a person is amenable to treatment. And if there's evidence presented to a sentencing judge that a person may be amenable to treatment, as a judge, I would prefer to have that person into a drug court setting where I know in the first phases of that program that adult offender is before the court every week, instead of just on a probationary status where I may not see that person every week. I think it's good from the standpoint of public safety. I think it's good from the standpoint of accountability for that particular offender. So that's the benefit of a drug court, in my opinion, as an adult drug court. But again, I don't have an adult drug court at this time in Chisago. Thank you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Vader, early in your comments, you made a comment that said, "Punishment does not change behavior." And then toward the end, you said, "One thing that does work is sanctions." Could you define sanction versus punishment for me?
Ms. Vader?
Punishment is putting some sort of a consequence that is not giving them a choice. If, for example, a sanction, we can sanction them to house arrest. We can sanction them to community service. A punishment means you go to lockup and you're there, and you come out and you're done, and we wait until you do something else. There's no follow-up. There's no continuum. There's no constant, consistent performance that they have to face us with.
Mr. Chair, one other question I did have is, do you find that the offender, and you hinted on it in your comment, that of the young person that analyzed in his mind how far he could use drugs before he got into serious criminal behavior or a criminal reaction by the courts, does that hint on the idea that these folks who offend actually know the law and that they're making a critical analysis of how far they can go before they get caught and they go bring it right up to the line?
Mr. Chair and Senator, if I could, in roughly defined, yes, they do. They know the police officers. They know how the system works. Do they know exactly the law? Probably not. Some of them may. The Internet has provided access. But in, for example, what the young man that really brought that home to us said is, I was a five-time repeat felon before I really got a consequence. And they also told us that if you brought the hammer down early on, we probably wouldn't be a five-time repeat felon. And that has made an impact on the courts in our county. The judicial system, the attorneys paid attention to that. Coming from kids, that's pretty loud and clear.
Judge Radker.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that a little bit, Senator. In Chisago County, we started a program with my two other judges to require mandatory appearances for underage consumption offenses on first offenders. And we started doing pre-screen assessments and follow-up with chemical use assessments. And we started finding out that those young people, that was part of the preventative piece, we started finding out that those young people needed full-blown chemical use assessments, a fair amount of them. The knowledge in the community became, don't get caught in Chisago County because you have to appear in court on underage consumption cases. And they started going over geographical boundaries in a Washington County or other counties where there are payables. So when you talk about the network of knowledge, it is quite incredible.
But you do have a problem, it seems to me, with a juvenile offender that he will lack the ability to incarcerate somebody there for a petty misdemeanor.
That is correct. And a lot of the juvenile petty offenders, Mr. Chair, it would be nice if you had a program using some of the drug court principles to start intervening early with them. But because of our short probationary periods, we just don't have the time to deal with them. But you're right.
It seems to me more there, though, the problem is that we can't afford to get a public defender in order to permit the case to move forward.
That's correct.
Proceeding on, we have Barb Klein.
Mr. Chair, we have two more
Change
witnesses with respect to the drug court. Bonnie Klein is a drug court graduate in the Stearns County Adult Court, and County Attorney Jim Backstrom from Dakota County, who is a member of the Supreme Court's Chemical Dependency Task Force.
Light in there.
Mr. Chairperson?
Turn that overhead off so it doesn't shine in, unless you've got some more slides you're going to use.
Hit what?
You're the chief judge of the Court of Appeals. Got all that stuff.
Over there.
Thank you.
There we go.
Ms. Klein.
Mr. Chairperson, Senators, my name is Barb Klein, and I entered the Stearns County Drug Court System in September of 2002, and I was the first graduate from the same system in December of 2003. Obviously, I'm a drug addict. My drug of choice would be prescription narcotic opiates. Judge had given some statistics earlier alluding to that. I worked as a nurse for close to 20 years, so you can about imagine how I obtained my drug of choice. When I entered the Stearns County Drug Court System, that was my third run-in, for lack of a better term, with community corrections. The first time was in 1994 through Stearns County. I received a sentence of 2 days in the county jail and 1 year probation. Then in the year 2000, I entered the Wright County Community Corrections System. I was charged with and pled guilty to a fifth degree possession of a controlled substance at the felony level. I spent 4.5 months in the Wright County Jail. Went on probation after that, and I, at that point, relapsed after approximately 4 months. Not good. Upon my entry into the Stearns County Drug Court System, It followed another very embarrassing arrest. I stole drugs from very vulnerable people in our society, extremely vulnerable people. The last 10 years of my nursing practice, I actually worked in mental health and chemical dependency. I was supposed to be their advocate, and I was stealing their drugs. Prior to my arrest, I was aware that I was falling down in a pit that I most likely would not be able to claw myself out of. Upon arrest, immediately, I realized that I had absolutely no hope of living a sober life, of becoming a contributor to the society again, of being a mother, of being a wife, and I planned to kill myself at that point. Now, nurses know the most lethal way to do that, and I chose that method. I woke up in the emergency room some hours later with the physicians and the EMTs telling my husband and my daughter that they had absolutely no idea why I was waking up. When I was found by the EMTs, I was pronounced dead at that time. I first entered the courtroom for the Stearns County Drug Court approximately a month after that. I had never heard the term drug court before, but I had no hope at that point of achieving any form of sobriety and trying to re-enter society again. My very first day there, I sat down and spoke with the judge, with the public defender, with members from social services, with the whole team. And I was astounded. I was very suspicious because I had never found a jail sentence, a deterrent for my use. And upon conviction at this point, I was facing prison time. And that's where I figured I was going. These people forced me for the first time in my life in approximately 10 years to be honest. And it came to me that if these virtual strangers were willing to take this leap of faith with me, the very least I could do was to do the best I could. It forced me to be honest. It forced me to be accountable. I realized now that subconsciously, that's what I was screaming for. I want to be accountable. I want to contribute to society. I want people to realize who I really am sober. I went through the drug court system in Stearns County without any sanctions, which sounds easy, but it was not. The weekly visits in the courtroom, I worked my butt off to get to where I am today. When I was in Wright County, every day I was presented with my drug of choice, illegally. It was offered to me daily while in jail. Immediately upon discharge from the jail, it was very prevalent at that point as well. Throughout the drug court system, if I would have used, I would be in prison today. And I was forced again to be accountable, to be honest. Practicing that every day throughout the whole system of the drug court process, today it's a habit, it's who I am. I can present to you today the real Barb Klein, the sober Barb Klein. Next week, I will celebrate 3 full years of sobriety. I am working in a professional position at this point in central Minnesota. I am still married. I have a daughter that actually is present with me today. She is in her senior year of a social work program at St. Cloud State University. I'm alive, which was my purpose all along. With that, I want to thank you.
You.
And sit on.
Mr. Backstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney and President-elect of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. all of you know, although many people in the public sometimes get confused, but I am a member of the executive branch of government. Many people think I'm in the judicial branch, but county attorneys intersect, obviously, a lot with our judicial partners, but we are the enforcers of the law and carry out our executive branch functions on a daily basis. But I raise that point for one reason, and that is to point out that for drug courts to be successful, it requires the collaboration of all of our branches of government, our legislative, judicial, and executive branches, to make these efforts successful. I have to tell you that in my role as a law enforcer, when I first heard of drug courts 4 or 5 years ago, I was skeptical about the opportunity what they would offer in terms of dealing with crime in our communities. And I think many in law enforcement were skeptical about this process, thinking it's maybe a little too touchy-feely type issues. But, you know, as I became a member in the last 2 years, I was privileged to be appointed by the Supreme Court to be on the Chemical Dependency Task Force. I've had an opportunity to learn a great deal more about the operations of drug courts in our state and across our nation, and I have become convinced that drug courts hold great promise to address this specific and troubling criminal caseload that dominates our criminal justice process. It is clearly the largest influence on crime in our communities today when you consider drugs and alcohol combined. It's also important to remember, though, from a law enforcement perspective, and I think our partners are now understand this, is that drug courts are not for everyone. They are not for violent criminal offenders. They are not for offenders who are in gangs, using guns, who are selling large quantities of drugs to our children and other citizens in our communities. Those offenders rightfully belong in prison. But for the vast majority of drug abusers that we come into contact with in our criminal justice system, I believe drug courts can make a huge difference. And I can't say it any better than the testimonial you just heard from a graduate of drug court whose life was truly saved by being allowed an opportunity to participate in this type of a program. And it is a unique and novel approach to dealing with crime that involves much more intensive interaction between a judge and other criminal justice professionals who take the time to really talk to a criminal offender, to let that offender know that they care about him or her and their futures, and they care and understand the roles that addiction plays in dominating their lives, and that we care about making them whole again and have an opportunity to be productive and law-abiding citizens in our community. We care about those things just as much as we care about keeping drugs away from our children and keeping our communities free and safe from crime. This drug court allows those two processes to merge. I think that hope is a very fleeting prospect for many non-criminals in our society, especially those with mental health needs, as the chair pointed out earlier. But for those who are chemically addicted, hope is virtually non-existent, and I think you heard that so vividly from Ms. Klein just a few moments ago. These chemicals take control of their brains, take control of their lives, and they can think of little or nothing else. If we can restore hope to a drug addicted offender, I believe we can start them on a road to recovery with the realization that they've not only hurt themselves, but they've hurt their families, their friends, and all of the citizens in the communities in which they reside. I believe that drug courts can do that more quickly and more effectively than any other approach that I have observed in my now almost 30 years of working in the Dakota County Attorney's Office. So with that, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to let you know that although my colleagues, the prosecutors in our state, and our law enforcement leaders were initially skeptical, some are still skeptical of drug courts, but I think they hold great promise, as I've said, I support them. Most of my colleagues support them, and we are looking to partner with our judicial partners in making drug courts a reality and a success in Minnesota, and we will do just that with your support. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bagstrom. I think that shows you the direction we're going with the drug courts, and to gain your acceptance is wonderful, I would say. Thank you. Sue?
I touched it, so I might be in trouble. Oh, I touched this one.
I don't want to press it.
Maybe it'll come back.
That would never happen on my touch.
Did you say you don't use computer?
No.
No. What century do we live in?
My mind is the ultimate.
Technology.
We got a flashing red light.
Maybe I can go on with the slides, and maybe could you find the technologist who was here before? And we Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, would you mind if we skipped out of order and we went to the one a little further ahead in the slides? We have a number of witnesses that we just want to make sure that they appear. I'd like to move on, if I might, to slide 32. Skipping forward now to our next category of requests. Okay, something's happening here. Yeah, if you can go to slide 32.
Okay.
That'd be great. It's so wonderful to have this, okay? These requests, legally mandated requests, really come out of constitutionally and statutorily required services that we have no control over. The ability to not do these services, they're a direct result of workload growth and the cost increases in these four categories. And the first of these is in the guardian ad litem categories. Many of you know the Children's Justice Initiative has been a focus area of ours since the year 2000. And the reason that it has been and why we here are here asking for guardian ad litem funding is because it doesn't take rocket science to understand that if we don't deal effectively with children early on, that with high probability, many of child victims will become victimizers for whom we will pay over and over again. And this importance of a guardian ad litem has long been understood. In 1974, the federal government mandated the appointment of a guardian ad litem in every juvenile court case in which abuse or neglect was alleged, and made that a condition of federal foster care money to the states. A year later, Minnesota passed its parallel statute and extended guardian ad litem appointments to family cases as well when abuse and neglect is alleged. And until recently,
Sue, do you want to explain for those that might not understand what a guardian ad litem is?
I will. And the very next slide is a guardian ad litem is an advocate for the best interests of a child who have many important responsibilities, including conducting an independent investigation to determine the facts surrounding the child and the family, with broad information gathering responsibilities, advocating for the child's best interest, including services throughout, and presenting a written report with recommendations for what is in the best interest of this child in these cases, of both CHIPS cases and termination of parental rights, and presenting that to the court. Now, since 2004, the number of maltreated children have increased significantly each year. We've grown from about 11,000 in 2004 to we project 14,000 in this year. That's a 27% increase, even though we've had no new funding. Now, to give you some insight on in terms of the importance of a guardian ad litem in these CHIPS cases, I'd like to call on Ed Cassidy, who is here as a guardian, a volunteer guardian ad litem in Ramsey County.
Thank you, Sue. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, I'm Ed Cassidy. I live in St. Paul. I'm an attorney in private practice in our firm's St. Paul office. I've been a guardian for about 6 years. I'm also the chair of the Ramsey County Corrections Board, so I'm in tune with some of the issues that you've just been hearing about. In June of 2001, about a mile from here, federal agents and local police raided a house, arrested — the house had been under surveillance for about 6 weeks. They arrested 8 or 9 adults, including a young woman. In the back room of the house, there were 3 young children, DS, DS, and JC. 3 years old, 5 years old, and 6 years old. They were emaciated, terrified. The police report initially described them as catatonic. Likewise, the emergency foster mother. Children were moved into a foster home in July of 2001. A CHIPS proceeding was started. I was appointed the children's guardian. The children, for months, would not talk. But over time in the foster home — it was a unique foster home. Foster mother had 8 or 9 of her own children. There were adults lived nearby. Many grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and cousins were constantly going through this house. And eventually, the 3 children began to open up. Complicating the problem was the children's mother was not sticking with her case plan that had been assigned by the child protection worker. Complicating matters further as the mother would disappear for months on end. Eventually, a termination petition was filed, and that was set for October of 2002, almost a year and a half later. Now, in the meantime, the mother had essentially stopped seeing the children. The children were flourishing. The mother voluntarily terminated her rights in October of 2002. In June 01, when the children were first put into foster care, the maternal aunt and maternal grandmother had been contacted. They lived in Chicago and asked if they wanted the children. They said no. The children in late 2002 were transferred to the guardianship unit, which has responsibility for finding an adoptive home. I advocated at the time that local adoptive parents should be sought out, and adoptive parents that would continue the relationship with the foster mother, which was now incredibly close. They were bonded. She was grandmother, probably the only stable adult relationship they'd ever had, other than, it turns out, with me. Foster parent or prospective adoptive parents were identified. They agreed to maintain this relationship. A petition to adopt was going to be filed. All of a sudden, grandmother from Chicago calls and wants the children. Likewise, the sister. It says part of our job is to investigate. Now, keep in mind the benefit or the advantage of being a guardian is that you are on these cases from the beginning till the end. You know everybody. I called the mother's probation officer. She said that her probation, which had been in Washington County, was moved to Chicago, and gave her mother's address. That's where she's living. So it seemed reasonably clear to me what was going on. We made a motion in August of 2003 to compel the county to place these children in an adoptive home in the Twin Cities. The grandparents and, or the grandmother and aunt filed a competing motion and an adoption petition. The district court eventually ruled in our favor. The family appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals and on the Supreme Court, and the guardian's recommendations were upheld all the way, and it was finally they were finally adopted almost 3.5 years later in February of 2005. Now, the reason that we were able to get the result we got was because, again, the guardian is there from the beginning through to the end. I had available to me, even as a practicing lawyer, I found the juvenile proceedings mystifying. I had available to me an expert lawyer who represented me. Also, the guardian and litem office in Ramsey County is staffed with full-time supervisors who also help. Now, you heard compelling testimony about the drug courts, what they deal with in terms of the cycle of drug use, addiction, violence, incarceration that's now spanning generations. Those drug courts, I believe, are a good way to stop that cycle and can be effective. Another way is to stop it before it starts. If the system hadn't intervened in the lives of these three children I was just describing and hadn't gotten a good result, and they wouldn't have gotten a good result without a guardian, those three children, the chances of those three children ending up in the juvenile justice system approach 100%. Now they're in a stable home, loving parents, go to school every day, they've got a chance. And this case is not unique. It happens every day. This is the kind of work that guardians do day in and day out. And it is a very reasonable way, cost-wise, to stop this cycle. Thank you.
In your looking at guardian ad litem, you've got appointed and others that are not part of the county or the state. Is that right?
Sorry, I didn't.
Whether you have people that are GAL that may be salaried and some that are not?
Mine is, I would defer to Sue on that.
Mr. Chair, there's a combination of them. We have very few guardian ad litem employees. We have nearly 500 contractors, and we have about an equal number of volunteer guardians ad litem as well. We have a mixture of the volunteer guardian ad litem are primarily in Hennepin and Ramsey County, which have quite an expansive training and supervisory infrastructure for that. And then in outstate, we have primarily contractors.
Sarah Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dosal, are most guardian ad litem attorneys?
Mr. Chair and Representative Higgins, or Senator Higgins, no. Almost none are. And that's why we have available, when needed, some attorney representation. Some of it we've gotten begged, borrowed, and stealed by this initiative of Chief Justice Blatt's, and that is part of the issue. In many other states, guardians ad litem are attorneys. The problem is that at their hourly rates, the information gathering that Ed and other guardian ad litem are supposed to do wasn't getting done, and that was the case here in Minnesota. So we've opted for a model where a little lower cost individuals, having them do all of that information gathering, and then when they need a lawyer for complicated and contested matters like this, we try to find it one way or the other.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is the request that we are making for the guardian ad litem needs, so eloquently indicated by Mr. Cassidy, for funding additional needs in this program area. Now, the second of the legally mandated services requests that we have is for interpreters. And to give you some insight into the significance and importance of interpreters, we have Judge Salvador Rosas for Ramsey County.
Welcome to the committee, Judge Rosas.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I would like for you to imagine
Would you please state your name for the...
I'm sorry, record. Salvador Rosas. I'm a district court judge in Ramsey County.
Thank you.
I would like the members of the committee to imagine themselves on a trip to Latin America. You can't speak the language. A vacation has suddenly turned bad for you. You've been arrested by police. You've been held in custody. You've been interrogated, but you don't know what they're asking. And after a couple days in custody, you appear in front of somebody who might look like me. And that person begins to speak to you in Spanish. And he begins to say, ¿Cómo te llamas? ¿Tienes un abogado? Usted tiene el derecho a un abogado en todos procedimientos. Si usted no puede pagar los honorarios para un abogado, la corte le asignará uno. Usted tiene el derecho a un juicio por un jurado o un juicio por un juez. A usted no se le requiere decir nada. Cualquier cosa que diga puede ser usado en contra de usted en cualquier otro procedimiento. Now, and that's the point. When you don't understand the language spoken in court, in civil, juvenile, or criminal proceedings, on a case that involves important matters, like the custody of your children, your property, your liberty, a lot depends on the availability and competency of qualified court interpreters. So let me repeat what I just said using the services of a court-certified interpreter. ¿Cómo te llamas?
What is your name?
¿Tienes un abogado?
Do you have a lawyer?
Usted tiene el derecho a un abogado en todos los procedimientos.
You have a right to be represented by a lawyer in any procedure.
Si usted no puede pagar los honorarios de un abogado, la corte le asignará uno.
If you cannot afford to contract an attorney, one may be appointed for you by the courts.
Usted tiene el derecho a un juicio por un jurado o un juicio por un juez.
You have a right to a trial by jury or in front of a judge.
Members of the committee, a few years ago I appeared before this group asking for support for court interpreters. Since then, the need for qualified court interpreters has not diminished. As a matter of fact, the significant increase in the size of Minnesota's non-English speaking populations has resulted in increased demands upon our courts to meet the needs and protective rights of persons handicapped by language. Interpreters are a crucial component of our system of justice. And if you are concerned, as I am, with ensuring that the rights of all people who appear in our courts are protected, you must provide the necessary resources for court interpreters to ensure equal justice for all.
Can you tell me that seems to me that where we are flawed is that there needs to be somebody that has the capabilities of the language to be out with the police and the others and not wait till he's into court or she's into court.
Well, the statute provides that at any significant stage of the proceedings, including after incarceration and during interrogation, a person who's limited English speaking is to be assigned a qualified interpreter. Now, in the past, sometimes police agencies have used their own people, and I think that there have been court of appeals cases, Supreme Court cases that have said that that's not the process that should be used. When police are interrogating individuals, for example, they should use competent court interpreters that have been provided in a list by the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
We just have a few slides that basically highlight, again, this is a constitutional requirement, but also a statutory requirement. This is the policy of the state for all proceedings, both criminal and civil, that those handicapped in a communication have the right to a qualified interpreter. Just you can see the increasing population of non-English speaking people. We're having 73 different languages on our interpreter roster, thousands of these hearings every year. And this definitely is not just a metro problem. This is a statewide problem. And you have this example of Worthington, where 1 in 5 proceedings now are in another language, and not just Spanish, other languages. Jeff Flynn, who's the judge in that area, said one day he had 3 different languages in one case. So it's the diversity is phenomenal, and here are just the top 20 languages that we use most regularly, just give you some idea of the diversity of the languages. This is the increase in expenses for court interpreters that we have incurred over the last number of years. Again, once again, no new money has been provided for this since 2003, so it is totally outpacing our ability to fund these, and we are asking for about $1.3 million to meet the demands of those constitutional and statutory demands for interpreters, because at bottom, there can be no justice without comprehension. So I'm going to continue on the legally mandated services. The third of these areas is psychological services. And Minnesota statutes require that the courts pay for psychological examinations in Rule 20 competency examinations in criminal matters, as well as in civil commitment cases. Now, these highly skilled licensed psychologists and psychiatrists provide these services, and we can see the continual increase in cost here because of rise in filings, increased complexity of these exams, and increased hourly rates. Now, you can see there has been a remarkable increase in the demand for psychological services and the cost since 2003. The basic case drivers are an increase in criminal cases as well as an increase in civil commitments. But by far, the most important growth area here is the result of the increased cost and the numbers of cases that have been filed in the area of sexually dangerous persons. And this is a result of the change in the Department of Corrections policy of referring many more of the level 3 sex offenders for possible civil commitment. Now, each of these cases, these psychological exams, are somewhere in the range of 8,000 to 15,000. So you can imagine the cost increases. I believe that before, in 2002, before the Drew Shadeen incident, there were 14 of these that were referred. Now it's somewhere between 100 and 175. I believe it was 175 last time. So this has been this significant increase in cost and demand for these services that we have no choice but to provide. So this is the request that we are asking for in the next biennium to meet these demands for the psychological services that are critical in all of the areas that I described, but most importantly coming from the cost pressures of these the level 3 sex offender civil commitments.
Didn't we require those folks that had insurance, had to cover them?
I don't know that. Dr. Larry Pansiera is here from Hennepin County, and he handles the unit in Hennepin County that deals with this.
Mr. Chair, I believe most of these are appointed by the court. They work for the court, so payment is not insurance is not an issue here.
I think it's a criminal matter.
I think Senator Betzel is correct that
you state your name.
Yeah, name is Lawrence Pansiera from Hennepin County District Court Psychological Services. That if in the billing process you were to make it clear to the insurance that this is a result of a court-ordered forensic evaluation, it would not be covered. And, so that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Any other questions about that? The last of these services is for Informa Pauperis, IFP services, and we're asking for $178,000 more. These are costs for services like service of process, publication, copying, transcripts in non-criminal areas for litigants who cannot afford it. And this, again, is a statutory requirement that the court pay for these services.
Those determined that they're not able to pay by only after they've been in court?
There is an application, and it requires that some of the same eligibility requirements as for civil legal services. A judge has got to order that the person is indigent in order to receive these services. That's correct. There's an application process for that.
Sarah Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dozel, it says these are for non-criminal cases?
That's right.
What happens in criminal cases?
Well, in criminal cases, these costs are paid for by the by the state, one way or the other, out of some budget or another, either public defenders, prosecutors, or someone else, not by the individual. But in most civil cases, you'd pay for your own transcript if you had a civil matter. It would not be a state responsibility. But by statute, if you're indigent, some of these basic costs to provide access to justice for those that are low income are required to be paid absorbed by the court. The next category of requests that we have is for caseload growth, and this relates to judgeships to meet these increasing demands. Now, as I indicated before, we have nearly 2 million cases that we hear each year in the court. About 223,000 of these we consider to be major cases. These would be felonies and gross misdemeanors, civil, probate, family, and juvenile cases. And although they only take up about 11% of our overall filings, they represent the vast bulk of our judges' time, what they spend their time on. These major cases have increased over the decade. Today we have about 25,000 more than we did 10 years ago. By far, the fastest growth area is in the criminal filings area. Major criminals are felonies and gross misdemeanors, 54% in this last decade. Now, we have about 64,000 of these cases. Half of them are felonies. The other half are gross misdemeanors. And since 2005, between 2005 and 2005, felonies have increased by 44% and gross misdemeanors by 24%. So what's been the impact of that? As you can see, the impact is increasingly without the kind of adequate resources that we need to handle these cases. The stress on the system is that backlogs and delays are beginning to occur. We have by statute, and we've also adopted by court policy, essentially the American Bar Association standards that say for felony and gross misdemeanor cases, 90% of those cases are to be disposed of within 4 months, 97% within 6 months, and 99%, virtually all of them within 1 year. You can see in the bar on the right that we are not coming close to meeting those time standards. And, of course, this is important not just because justice delayed is justice denied, which surely it is, but also because it undermines deterrent. Things that we heard from folks in the drug court. What has been shown empirically in terms of research is that the single biggest factor in reducing recidivism is the swiftness in time or the shortness of time between the criminal offense and the imposition of a judicial sanction. And that's a much bigger and more important factor than the type of penalty or even the length of incarceration. So we have, since 1980, used the weighted caseload analysis for determining objectively how many judges we need in the state. Weighted caseload is a comprehensive time and motion study that we do for 9 weeks involving all of our judges throughout the state to determine, on average, how long does it take to dispose of 49 different kinds of cases. We then take those weights or those times, multiply that times to the different case mix in every county, and we come up with how many judges we need and in what locations. So based on that analysis, which we have used, as I've indicated, for 27 years, and based on the end-of-year filings in 2005, which was the last full year we had before submitting our budget, our request is for 9 judgeships. If we were to use filings that we are now seeing in this increased filings in this current year, 2006, we would need 14 judgeships. But our request is for 9 judgeships, and they would be located as indicated on this slide here. I think it's interesting to note that these are all over the state, and they are not metro area. It's not Hennepin and Ramsey that we're asking for new judgeships for. It is in other parts of the state where we're experiencing some significant growth. So to give you a view from the trenches about what this caseload pressures are, I would like to call on Judge Dave Knudsen and Judge David Tenek, who can talk to you a little bit about their experiences on the bench.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. It's a pleasure to be here.
You can use this.
You know, we both changed a little bit since we left this body. I'd just like you to know that my hair's not gray.
You have hair?
Yeah. We could see about a wig if you need.
Well, as Sue mentioned, you know, the core value of one of the core values of the court system is that citizens deserve fair and equal treatment and service from the judicial system. And in order to get that, they need judges that are there and have the time to deal with their case. And as she just recently said, that swift court action is the only proven deterrent to repeat offenses. And I just want to give you briefly a little idea of what's happening in Dakota County, where I'm seated. In 2006, we had 4,400 gross misdemeanor and felony files open. In 2007, now, in the first month and a half, we've had 560 gross misdemeanor and felony cases filed. If we continue on that pace in Dakota County for the rest of the year, we will approach 6,000 gross misdemeanor and felony files. Right now, when that case comes in and is filed, it's almost 2 months before we can schedule that matter for a first appearance. I'll give you an example on misdemeanor cases. In 2005, we had 58,000 misdemeanor cases. In 2006, we had 60,000. And the same thing, for some reason, is happening, that over the first month here, if we were to continue with what's been filed in January, if that continues throughout the year, we're going to be looking at almost 77,000 misdemeanor cases filed in Dakota County. That's almost a 27% increase over the last year. So trying to deal with that is very, very difficult without the judges necessary to hear these cases and to have the cases set on and scheduled in a timely manner. Just this morning, as an example, we split the felony and gross misdemeanor jury trial between two judges. I had 18 of them. So if you figure that out, that's about 10 minutes per file. So I had 10 minutes per file to get these matters resolved, worked on, try to figure out what we're going to do with them. And we were in a little bit of a bind today. Because we're short, we have 2 vacancies, and we have at least 2 openings, probably, well, 2 judgeships short, probably 3 judgeships short in the first judicial district. So we've got our judges spread out not only in Dakota County but throughout the first judicial district, of course, to handle all of the caseloads. So we did not have a judge that was ready to hear an actual trial today. So we cajole, we negotiate, we try to get these matters resolved. And if there's one thing I've learned in my short time on the bench, it's absolutely critical. You've heard the other testimony. We've got to make a connection with these folks. We've got to offer that hope. And the hope comes through personal relationships. The hope comes through somebody looking at them and understanding their plight. And that's in family law, that's in civil litigation, and that's particularly true with our criminal cases. People want to tell their story. They want to know that somebody cares. And being on the front line of that, we've got to have the time to do that. And as these caseloads increase more and more and more, we have less and less time. And the bottom line, I think, is that your constituents are our constituents. And frankly, they're not being served when we just don't have the time to sit and listen to their story. So we're counting on you, each of you, to be our advocates in this budget process. And we both know how difficult it is and how difficult it can be. But we really need some champions to help make our judicial system work and to increase the number of judges in our throughout our state. Thank you.
Mr. Tenney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is a little odd to be sitting on this side of the table and not be presenting a bill. But I thought what I would do is kind of walk you through what it's like for us in Crow Wing County on a weekly basis. We have four judges in Crow Wing County, of which three rotate through criminal, civil, and what we call master, and a fourth judge, which is strictly dedicated to juvenile work. But on the criminal calendar, and I brought calendars along so that you could take a look at them. On Mondays, we have a criminal calendar in the afternoon that typically runs 85 to 90 cases in an afternoon. We are often there until 7 or 8 at night. 8 is unusual. 6:37 is pretty typical. That's with another judge helping out the criminal judge. So we actually steal a judge. Hopefully the civil calendar gets over by then, and we steal a civil judge and have them help out. And fortunately, we all get along well, and we try and do whatever we can to help each other. But Mondays on the criminal calendar, it's easily after 6 every Monday. Tuesdays on the juvenile calendar, which I'm on right now, we often hold court till 7. Sometimes I had court until about 7:45 the other day. Thursdays, we have a criminal trial call. Typically, that will have 100 to 125 cases that are set on for trial that day, and you will have a mass of people there on that day. And every Monday morning and every Friday morning, we have arraignments for traffic calendar and misdemeanor cases. I brought one calendar along that has about 270 people were on the calendar that morning. Now, some of those are payable. There's a share of those that are payable, but it means you can come in and pay your speeding ticket.
Okay.
But if they aren't paid by a certain date, they get put on the calendar, which causes a huge amount of work for court staff to pull these files, put them all on the calendar, and get them ready to come into court. The difficulty and the frustrating part of that is when you walk into the courtroom and you see 100 people or 100 excess of 100 people waiting to have their cases heard. Some of them are people that have speeding tickets, just general public who may or may not have a valid defense. And they look around the room and they figure, this is not worth it. I'm going to pay, walk out the door, go down to court administration, I'm innocent, and I got robbed by the system, but it's not worth it to me to stay. They can read the writing on the wall, but they come in, they plead not guilty, they're set on for another trial, another date for trial, and they'll be back there with another 100 people waiting for their case to be heard. And it's frustrating to me to see people, and you see it, I'm innocent, but I'm leaving and I'm going to go pay. That leaves a really bad taste in my mouth, and it's really based on I think, the excessive pressure we've placed on the, not just on the judges, but on the judicial system itself. Some of the things that we run into when you have these huge calendars is that you have a significant security issue in the court area, not just in the courtroom, but in the hallways. We've had several incidences of problems whether it's in juvenile court, outside juvenile court, outside criminal court. You sense a frustration with witness management from the prosecution and the defense side. When you have 100 cases set on for trial and you're trying to line up witnesses, it's nearly impossible to tell people, particularly from the prosecution standpoint, to tell people, we need you here on Tuesday morning. You don't know that. And we have a constant concern from the defense bar as well, is how do you actually manage a calendar that's that size and get it ready to go to trial and figure out when you're going to need your witnesses there. There is, I think, a growing frustration, at least from our perspective in Crow Wing County, growing frustration with not meeting the citizens, like Judge Knudsen said, not meeting the citizens on, I don't know if even ground is the right term, but having the citizens have some faith in the system that they're getting a fair shake when they come into the court system. And that's a growing perception, and it's a growing concern to the, at least the bench, when we get together and talk about it. I can also tell you that these long days bring not only frustration in the litigants, but it brings frustration and what I would consider an unacceptable stress level in staff too. It's a staggering task to watch my court staff try and manage that number of cases. We now bring cases to court in shopping carts. And sometimes it takes more than one shopping cart for the afternoon, depending on what kind of cases we have. So you get a picture of not only what's going on in the courtroom, but what's going on in the back room and in the court administration's office in terms of sheer volume of management of these numbers of cases. We have a real problem with court reporter burnout. Court reporters, I'm convinced, they have a limited number of strokes in their hands in a lifetime. And we have one that's had hand surgery. My court reporter now is suffering physical problems from the days that start at 8 in the morning and go until 7 or 8 at night with literally no relief. We take lunch and we take breaks, but you just keep going. And I can't say it any better than how Judge Knudsen said it, that we're reaching a point of overload here. And it's frustrating, I think, to all of us in the system to watch the perception of the system start to erode. And I think that's a very real and a very dangerous situation. And I can tell you that at least in the Ninth District, where I'm really well-versed in who's handling what cases, we are in desperate need of more judges. And I think that the distribution that's been put together would help move the ball forward here in this case. And I would really appreciate, and I know as Senator Knudsen said, really appreciate anything you can do for us in the judiciary, because right now in our district, things are, particularly in Crow Wing County and a couple other areas, and we fine-tune our calendars on a regular basis trying to figure out a way to make this work better. And we don't stack these things up on some day so that we say we can go to the legislature and tell you what a bad day we have. We have occasionally. None of us want to be there at 8 o'clock at night. I can tell you my staff doesn't want to be there at 8 o'clock at night. So I want to impress upon you, this is a very real problem that we're facing out there from a couple of different fronts. But thank you very much for your time.
It reminds me of...
If any of you want to take a look at these calendars, I'll pass them out. I didn't want to get them all copied because there's hundreds of pages here, but you're more than willing to take a look at those.
And the thing I'd like to throw out is that it's a historical thing. I was a State Patrol District Commander in Minneapolis District, and in 1968, Congress passed some legislation dealing with safe streets. And at that time, we had in Hennepin County a 48-month backlog for jury trials. So when you were looking at this, if they pled not guilty, you'd have to dismiss it later on because the witnesses were gone and the other kinds of things. So I know how that can work. Senator Limmer.
Thank you. This question could be answered by either judge. There's a premise that anyone in a criminal court could, or charged with a criminal crime, could seek a speedy trial. And if a defendant sought a speedy trial, would we be capable of offering that to them in some, if not all, of our judicial districts? And I don't know if the public or those of us on this committee understand, but if the court system can't provide a speedy trial at the request of a defendant, then there's some dire consequences that I don't think many legislators really know about. Could you expand on that so we know, at least from the court system, what those consequences would be?
Well, just briefly, it's not only a speedy trial demand, but it's a speedy omnibus demand. So they have their first appearance, and they demand a speedy omnibus hearing in 28 days. And that's where we're getting backed up. We're seeing omnibus calendars. This is like a pretrial. We're trying to settle, resolve, make sure discoveries exchange. We end up doing in the system is just keep pushing the ball forward, and we don't have enough time to resolve them. Or as I mentioned earlier, Dan, let people have the sense that they've felt like they've been hurt. So it's not only the omnibus calendars that are getting extraordinarily large, and then it's the trial calendars that are getting extraordinarily large. We try to make sure that if there is a speedy demand requested, that we do that, but then what that does is push off other ones and fills up the calendars. And so we're out till the end of April right now. So the cases that couldn't get resolved today, we set them on for a trial at the end of April. So you've got another March, April, 2.5 months before you're going to go to trial. Some of these cases are already over a year old.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I can respond to that too. When we set the trial calendar in the criminal block, speedy trial demands go on first. There's a ranking that you go through. And often in our trial block, we will occasionally, if there's two or three speedy trial demands and we know they're going to go, we'll try and either get a retired judge to come in and help us out, or we will, somebody on civil, or we will make the arrangements to make that work. That doesn't always work. I think recently we had a gentleman that was released from custody because the speedy trial demand was not met. He had a serious offense. It was a property crime. But I'm not sure, but I think he was released not long ago, a couple weeks ago, on that very issue that we couldn't get his trial in 60 days.
Mr. Chair, I think there's some states, especially out in New England, if I remember right, not too many years ago, Connecticut, was it? New Hampshire, one of those states, where the state didn't adequately fund the courts. A defendant for first-degree murder demanded a speedy trial, and because the courts couldn't respond, they had to let that guy out. They had to open the door and let him go. And I don't think any of us as public policy makers want to ever come to that day where you have a serious offender who's charged with a crime, and then we have to let him go because we didn't adequately fund that court system. We seem to promote our budgets in a variety of other ways, but the judiciary branch is a vital branch to the way we govern ourselves, and I'm not pleased with the budget that I've seen, at least from the administration. I think they're a bit short-sighted. I hope we can help them out a little bit, the judiciary.
Senator Higgins is going to help me do that.
How would that be? I'm going to give all the money in my division to yours?
That's a good hand, so I can tell.
Questions for Judge Tenaik. How many staff do you judges have? How many staff people go along with this addition in judges? Maybe Ms. Dozel?
The judgeship unit that we're requesting would include a court reporter and a law clerk and two court administration staff to support the work that you're talking about in the back room with files and all of that. That's what the judgeship request would include.
And then my next question, Judge Chenik, is why is there ethnicity marked on every one of these?
They're doing a survey, and they're trying to get the data on how people coming into court.
It's part of the racial profiling stuff?
It isn't
maybe
bad,
still no. Saga speak. That happened quite a while ago.
It's a part of our race fairness task force. You might remember a number of years ago. They recommended that we collect race information on individuals so that we can then be able to determine how we're treating individuals within the court system. So we have a self-report race data collection effort that will be ongoing so that we can begin to produce information about are we treating persons of color any differently than others? And this is a very big issue, and we now are beginning to have enough data. We've collected long enough now to begin to really analyze this with in some depth. So it's a very important part. We know from the public opinion surveys that both white and persons of color believe that the justice system treats persons of color less fairly than the rest. And so this is a commitment on the part of the judicial branch to investigate itself, self-examine itself, and then figure out what we should do about it.
One more question.
Certainly.
Looking in this calendar, there are a boatload of seatbelt not in use, but we don't have primary offense yet. And so do we assume that there was some other reason they got stopped that isn't on here and they just hit them with the seatbelt? Is that how I should
Mr. interpret Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, that is probably they got pulled over for speeding at 10 over and the officer just wrote them for the seatbelt.
Nobody drives the speed limit in your county, it looks like. Ban run, that's right.
Senator Ingerbritz.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the report, judges. On that same note, we're talking about paying and running here. There's been some talk around the legislature about administrative fines, some counties and cities doing that, as well as diversionary fines. And now I'm understanding today I'm finding out that there are some diversionary programs actually out there for NSF checks. Can you tell me where that's coming from, or is that a hindrance to you or a help to the system here? By not having them there, I would assume it's certainly going to cut down on your caseload.
Sure, and the legislature has looked at some of that in the past, but it's really coming from what I can see, it's coming from the local units of government trying to capture more bigger chunk of the money that's coming out of here. But that's a dangerous deal because we've increased fees over time to help offset the costs for running the judicial system. So if we're going to now move some of these, make some of them administrative fines and fees payable to your local municipality, the state's going to lose out on that general income, general fund money. So.
My understanding also is there's no reporting of those convictions or those payables to the Department of Public Safety or that's one of the other issues. And I believe the Attorney General has issued an opinion that would not support these administrative fines process.
Senator Ingram, just to follow up on that, do you have any idea on numbers? I know Senator Foley's working on this. I could probably better get that from him. But do you have any ideas how many local units of governments are doing this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I submitted a report to the extent that we know that. We contacted our court administrators to ask what cities do they know or towns that are doing this, and we provided a complete list that we know about. There are many of them, many more than there used to be, so it is catching on around the state.
Thank you.
Further questions? Comments? I want to thank you, judges, for your work and so forth. I'm impressed with the fact that you were able to give up this wonderful life in the Senate and
go on to bigger and better things, but.
Do you miss us?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Don't want to ask us.
Mr. O'Sell?
Mr. Chair, the next witness is Chief Judge Edward Toussaint, who's going to talk about the need for judgeships on the Court of Appeals.
Welcome, Judge, and would you please state your name for the record?
Chair and members, my name is Edward Toussaint, and I've been fortunate to preside as the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Court of Appeals since 1995. For a clarification, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is a 16-member court. We sit in three-judge panels, and we travel to all parts of the state, you know, wherever the cases arrive. That is both a statutory responsibility that the court has. I learned as a trial court judge, though, that the jury will only listen if they are not tired. And you all have been, number one. Number two, that they will only listen depending upon how much bad news they're going to be receiving. And you've been receiving a lot of bad news today, and I want to just compliment you for your attention. My job today is to just talk a little bit about the Minnesota Court of Appeals and what has been happening to us. You've already heard about the increase in filings in the trial court. The Constitution and the statutes allow for people who are aggrieved with any decision made at the trial court to be able to appeal those decisions to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And likewise, that's true of state agencies, your county boards, your city councils. Those cases also come to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. In the at least since 1999, we've had an increase in filings, and this chart kind of gives you an indication as to that increase in filings. We've been up 18% since 99. Of course, as it is in the trial court, the number of filings, increase in filings is directly related to the number of criminal cases in the trial court. And likewise, it comes to us. But the number of filings are usually dispersed across the board. We have a lot of cases that are appealed that are civil, family law cases, juvenile cases, all of which ultimately come to our court. It might also interest you to know that approximately 95% of all appeals are ultimately resolved at the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Since 1999, with that increase in filings, we've had some also reductions in the percentage of increase in our budgets. And as a result of that, some things have occurred. Number one, we've had the inability to hire retired judges. The purpose of those retired judges are to sit on panels wherein a sitting judge recuses and or takes a vacation, and we substitute a retired judge in that position. Again, also in your footnotes, in the early years of my being the chief judge of this court, our retired judges were paid in the difference between their pensions and the salaries of the district court judges. And I noticed that some of our retired judges were making a whopping sum of about $9 per pay period. That's every 2 weeks. And so we were able to, based upon our budget, to be able to hire a number of retired judges, but that the compensation, the level of compensation has changed over the last several years, which has, of course, impacted our budget. Currently, we have about two retired judges per quarter, and their sole purpose, of course, is to sub into substitute into panels where a sitting judge does is either not there because of vacation or they're recusing for some other purpose. We've also had a reduction in staffing because of this reduced percentage in funding. We've lost those two law clerks. But since I've been there, we've also lost some staff attorneys, primarily to meet the budget crunch that we've had over time. What has happened to us is that we've had an increase in the number of cases that are ready to be heard, but an inability to place them on the calendar. Right now, as we sit today, we have about 550 cases that, if there were a calendar to put them on, we could set those cases on for hearing. Previously, we had been, previous to 1999, we had been able to set our cases on for hearings within 35 to 45 days when that last brief has been filed. Usually it's a respondent's brief wherein we set the hearing. Right now we're about 180 days. That's well below the ABA standards. Sue DeSalle talked about our pending cases at the trial court and how that relates to the ABA standards. And the ABA standards from last brief to submission is 55 days. And so now we are at 180 days. There was a time that we exceeded the ABA standards, but because of the nature of the increase in filings and the reduction of resources, we are no longer able to meet those standards. In 1983, the Minnesota Court of Appeals was instituted. The purpose of that court were many. The first purpose was, of course, to have every person who was aggrieved of any decision at either a trial court or some other agency to have a right of appeal. That was their primary purpose. Also, as you have done in Statute 488, you require that we write a written opinion in every case, and that we give reasons as to why the court makes a decision. We've complied with all of that. But the part of our charge where we are now failing is to have an early resolution of those issues. It has been bantered about that justice delayed is justice denied. And I'm glad I'm talking before Judge Lynch because when he talks, he makes people cry, and I'm unable to recover from that. So I thought I would just get a head start on him. But my whole purpose of trying to define for you what that means, what that term means, justice delayed is justice denied, is just to give you three examples and to show you what the impact of these three examples. So sorry. The first one is a juvenile case. This is a case where the juvenile was found guilty of attempted robbery after an August 05 incident at McDonald's in St. Cloud. There were a number of weapons involved in this prosecution. The juvenile was determined to be in extended juvenile jurisdiction in October of 05 and received their jury trial in November of 05, and that's pretty fast. He appeared for the disposition hearing in February of 06. There was an appeal to our court, and the transcripts from that trial were prepared, and they were all completed by June of 06. When all that occurs, ultimately, we set the matter on for hearing. We weren't able to hear that case until December. So June 06 to September 06, and this is a juvenile. So actually we're talking about 6 months of waiting for a decision from our court. The court in some cases, expedites the filing of the opinion. That doesn't mean that we short-circuit how that decision is to be written. However, we did that. And the panel issued an opinion very quickly within 1 month of the hearing. What was significant about this case is that our court decided that the trial lawyer made some was accused of ineffective assistance of counsel. We agreed and reversed the adjudication. And as a result of that adjudication, he has to go back for a new trial. Just giving you the time frame and the impact of those decisions. In 1999, we would have been able to make that decision 4 months sooner than what we made it in 2006, rather. And then, of course, all of you are familiar with this one. In August of 2005, Northwest Airlines imposed 25% pay cuts for union workers who worked as cleaners and as custodians, and those who worked as technicians and inspectors. More than 1,600 of those workers filed for unemployment compensation. The Minnesota Department of Employment Economic Security determined that the cleaner custodians were entitled to benefits, but not the technician inspectors. In October of 2005, Northwest appealed the allowance of benefits for the first group, and the technicians and inspectors appealed the denial of benefits to them. To us comes this appeal. The cases were briefed and ready for scheduling in February of 2006. Oral arguments were held 4 months later in June of 2006. The opinion was filed in September of 2006, wherein our court determined that both groups were entitled to those benefits. That case was then appealed by Northwest to the Minnesota Supreme Court, which denied review in October of 2006. And so just to give you that perspective, from August of 2005 to October of 2006, those people were not receiving benefits, and the amount of time really expired. Now, wherein that those families were impacted by the non-receipt of those benefits. And so ultimately, the request is not just for the Minnesota Court of Appeals, not in relationship to the ABA standards, but in relationship to the people that we serve, where we had promised to them that we were going to render expeditious, fair, and impartial decisions. And so thank you very much for your time.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, in the example of the young man in St. Cloud, was he held and was he incarcerated during all of that appeal period?
Yes, he was.
And now he's going to go through a new trial?
Yes.
Is he still incarcerated, waiting that new trial?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I didn't follow that all the way through, but it would appear to me that, yes, he's still in custody, and because we remanded the matter for a new trial, unless the trial court judge, once the case was remanded to the trial court for further disposition, they could have very well had a bail hearing and then have him released pending the new trial. But if not, yes, he's still incarcerated.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate your time. Mr. Sill?
Mr. Chair, how much time do you have for us?
What was it?
Do you want to continue on to? Very good. The next category of request is to maintain core justice operations, and I'm going to call on Judge Ed Lynch, who is going to put a tear in your eye, I guess, to talk about this request.
Good Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in the 1st Judicial District. I'm chambered in Dakota County in Hastings. I will be as quick as possible. My court reporter says she should get time and a half because I talk so quickly anyway, so I'll see if I can't proceed. The need to maintain core justice operations is the largest component of our budget request, and in my opinion, it's the most important because it affects our greatest resource and our most valuable asset, the 3,000 employees of the judicial branch. This funding will be needed to pay negotiated wage and insurance increases for our employees that are, for the most part, determined by the executive branch, and also to pay for increases in employer pension contributions that the legislature mandated last session. This request is not for any new positions. It is just to pay for and retain the employees we presently have. It also includes requested pay increases for judges that Sandy Nairn will talk about in a few minutes. Our need for well-trained, knowledgeable employees is driven by the volume of cases that are brought to the court every day. As you know, we have no control over the number of cases that are filed, and we have no authority to restrict access to the courts. We are constitutionally obligated to hear all cases promptly and without delay. Our workload is dictated by law enforcement officers and prosecutors enforcing state and local laws, the desires of citizens and businesses for redress, and the needs of children and vulnerable adults for protection. Many of these cases are sensitive, emotionally charged matters. They may involve a criminal matter affecting a person's freedom. They may involve a domestic matter affecting a person's family. It may involve a civil matter affecting a person's property. But in almost all instances, it's affecting the person's future. These people deserve timely access, respectful treatment, fair hearings, and impartial decisions. Many of the 2 million cases filed each year are disposed of with little, if any, involvement by judges, by our court administrative staff. These employees are the face of the justice system for most people who need the services of the court. I've said this before, and I believe it more now than ever, that they are not only the face of the justice system, they are the heart and the soul of the justice system. They interact with the public, answer questions, respond to requests, and help lawyers, jurors, witnesses, and litigants. They patiently explain the complex processes of litigation and help them understand unfamiliar, sometimes incomprehensible, terms and the complicated procedures of the court. Empirical research has shown that how litigants are treated is more important to their perception of fairness than the actual outcome of their case. Litigants and other court users in Minnesota have received timely, respectful, courteous treatment from our dedicated employees, and in a recent poll, 80% of respondents expressed confidence in the courts of Minnesota. I could share with you some examples, and I shared with you some examples, I think the last time I was before this committee about 2 years ago, about the type of services these people offer. And I just want to update a couple with some new stories that I've heard. A court employee takes with her every weekend the jury calendar for the following Monday, and she does that so that she can keep in contact with the attorneys involved to monitor settlements so that she only has to call in the bare minimum number of jurors so that she doesn't have to inconvenience those other people by calling them in if they're not absolutely necessary. Another court employee went out of her way and spent several hours searching records back to the 1950s because a person came to her office needing his naturalization verification, and he was turned away from other offices and agencies when he tried to get help from them. She also had to contact the Historical Society to get them to help in that search. And then I was told about a court employee who purchased with his own funds over the lunch hour a pet carrier. So a little boy who had been removed from an abusive mother in a child protection case and was being flown to Montana later that day to live with a father he hardly knew could take with him his one constant friend, his cat. Our court administrators and staff are not just paperwork processors. They are the foundation of our justice system and one of the key reasons the citizens of this state have confidence in our courts. This budget request allows us to maintain the foundation, protect it from deterioration, and ensure its strength. Now, Sandy Nairn will talk a little bit about the judge's request for compensation.
Maybe you're going to talk about per diem.
Per diem? No, I'm not going to talk about per diem.
We'll go with piecework, though.
Mr. Chair, members of the division, my name is Sandy Nairn. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. Our firm has had the honor for over 30 years of representing the trial bench before the legislature, and so I am here today on their behalf. As a brief background for new members of the committee and for some of the new staff, I just want to outline for you a couple factors that you may want to consider when you are making your decision about what to set for judicial compensation. The first is that the typical lawyer who accepts an appointment to the bench usually has, on average, about 18 years of experience either in private practice or in the public sector. And the average judge who is currently on the bench has been there for about 10 years. So in making your decision about what to set the wage at and what to set the salary at, you are talking about setting the salary for someone who has 28 to 30 years of experience in the practice of law, and it's something that we think you might want to consider. Also, judges are full-time professionals. They don't come into public service for short periods of time. Usually when someone takes the bench, they are there until the day they retire. So it's something that we think that you should consider in setting the salaries. Also, the legislature makes the final say on how judges are compensated. There are no formulas in statute that automatically give them cost of living increases, that give them any across the boards, that give them any merit increases. You decide the salary. If you don't give them any salary increase, they get nothing. In your packet, I think, and I've been told it's yellow sheets, there are two charts that I've put in for you to take a look at. One of them lists is a column of all the salary increases for judges over the last, I think, 35 years or so. And as you can see, they're erratic in nature. Sometimes they go, I think during one period in the 1990s, judges went 4.5 years with no raises whatsoever. I will clarify for you that during those years, the Senate did pass the pay raise every single year. It was the House where they failed to do so. And because of that, what ends up happening is then we come in and make requests to play catch-up and to try and ask for big increases. And that does cause problems, and it's certainly not the first choice of the judiciary to be coming in and getting no raises for a while and then asking for big raises. Also, I think on the back of that sheet or attached to that sheet is a piece that was prepared by the Legislative Coordinating Commission that shows you the pay raises given to MAPE and AFSCME employees over the last 22 years. It shows you the across-the-board increases, and it shows you the average merit or step increases that they were given during this time, and those are averages. And I do want to clarify that 100% of those employees do not always receive the step and merit increases. But as you can see, if you roughly add up some of the numbers, there is a big disparity between the percent increases given to judges over the last 22 years compared to what is given to other state employees. They are given regular incremental increases, and this has always been the first choice of the judiciary to get the same kind of increases. One other factor that's commonly taken into consideration in deciding what to compensate judges is how they compare with judges in other states. Historically, judges in Minnesota have usually fallen somewhere in the high teens in judicial compensation compared to judges in other states, 16, 18, 20. And that's usually been our goal, to stay in that range. We've never aspired to be in the top 10, but we've always tried to stay in at least the top half or so. Over the years, by 2001, because of the failure of legislature to grant increases during the 1990s, judges did fall to 35th in the country, behind Mississippi and Alabama. Kind of an uncomfortable position to be in. So the legislature was generous during the last number of years, brought the judges back up to 18th in the country, which is where we hoped to stay. And when we testified in 2005 before the legislature, we said, we're very happy with the position we're in now. Please just give the judges regular small incremental increases to keep them on par so that they don't slide. Unfortunately, because of budget constraints that you had at the time, they did not get enough to keep them on par, and they have now fallen to 24th as of last July and appear to be falling again. So our hopes are that we can play some catch-up here at some point. Another factor that's commonly taken into consideration is what lawyers are making in private practice. I don't know if any of you saw Minnesota Lawyer magazine yesterday, but they were showing information that, and here's the headline, the major firms in the Twin Cities are now starting entry-level lawyers beginning to work in their firm at $120,000 a year, which is almost identical to what a district court judge gets paid. Now, I'm not suggesting that we try and keep up with that because we never could, but it's certainly some barometer to take into consideration when you're making your decision about what judges should be paid, because we do like to hopefully get a broad spectrum of judges from various backgrounds and experiences applying for the bench. So it is something to consider when setting it. In doing some research to prepare for this hearing, I was surprised, though, to start comparing the growing disparity between judges and other public sector employees. There wasn't a lot of disparity before, but over the last several years, it's grown quite significantly. There are a number of elected county attorneys in the metro area that make significantly more money than the district judges that they appear before. And more interestingly, as a follow-up to the 2005 legislation that you passed that increased the local pay cap, we now have many assistant county attorneys in the metro area that are also making quite a bit more money than the district judges. So the disparity has grown. And I'm sorry that Senator Ingebrigtsen left, but we're also finding sheriffs who are getting paid more than the district court judges. And I do have to say that I have never seen that phenomenon before. That is certainly one of the first times I've ever seen that. The request in the budget here is for a 5% pay raise each of the next 2 years, July of 06 and July of 07. It's higher than the request that we made in 2005 because we're attempting to play a little bit of catch-up and increase the ranking nationally. We hope you'll take that into consideration when you're setting this. And in closing, one final comment I'd like to make, because I know you're pressed for time here, and this is probably a request that you don't hear from too many lobbyists who appear before you and talk with you, but I'd like you to consider some legislation that would basically put me out of a job. I'd like you to consider some kind of formula in state law that would automatically give judges increases every single year, tied to what the unions get or tied to what other state employees get. I have several formulas in mind that we've worked out with the department, but it's something I'd like you to consider so that judges will get automatic increases of some kind every year. The legislature, of course, would have the final say on appropriating the money, so you certainly wouldn't lose any of your leverage over that process, and you would still have the final say on whether or not it was appropriated. But it's something that I'd like you to consider when you are putting together your final budget. And I thank you for your time. I know you're...
We've reached the magic hour, and I'd say for those of you that are waiting to see Bruce or Jeremy that we're going to continue those to another day, that we just don't have time for that. Thank you all. Special thanks to the judges. We appreciate your taking time off of busy schedules and informing us how things are. Meeting adjourned.